Hello, I'm Mary Richards, and welcome once again to KHOI's Community Bookshelf, which can be heard every Monday, Tuesday, and Wednesday evening at this time. Hello, and welcome to the KHOI Community Bookshelf. We are reading The Horizontal World, Growing Up Wild in the Middle of Nowhere, by Deborah Marquardt. It was published in 2006 by Counterpoint, a member of the Perseus Books Group in New York. We rejoin the book at the point where Deborah is talking about illnesses and nervous habits and fears of her early childhood. In addition to the breathing and swallowing problems, I had other nervous foibles as a child. I was overly concerned with the edges of carpets. I imagined they had invisible safety fields that rose to a height of 1 or 2 feet around their fringed borders. So you couldn't just lazily step onto a carpet. No, you had to high-step your foot onto it so as not to trip the invisible laser beam that guarded the rug's edges. I was worried about what hid under the furniture. I believed that all of my dead grandparents slept in a tight group under my bed, which gave me some trouble with sleep. For a while, as a teenager, I had skin rashes, great flaking patches of psoriasis on my elbows and at my hairline. I had an excitable mind that rushed from subject to subject. At some point, I would stop myself and say, "Wait, how did I get to this thought?" Then I would try to think backwards. This thought led to that thought, which led to this other thought, etc. But I could never make my way back to the original thought. Before I had words to describe it, the ring of fire took over my field of vision. The blurry eye, I came to call it. "Mom, can you come and get me?" I'd learned to call my mother and ask. "I've got my blurry eye." Stress triggered it. Food triggered it. Later, hormones triggered it. But people became suspicious of my blurry eye. It would happen so suddenly. One moment I'd be talking and laughing in a group. Then, the next minute, I'd be ashen, saying, "I have to go. I've got my blurry eye." In time, I would learn I had 20 minutes to get to a safe, quiet place before the light blinded me. I'd learn to avoid all smells, especially food smells, even though my mother always seemed to be baking bread or slow-cooking a plump, juicy roast on the days when the blurry eye came. The acid smell of food would line my throat. The bathroom light, where I would go to shake aspirin out of the bottle, blinded me. The sound of my sister's laughter in the next room wounded me. The flannel blanket grated on my skin. "Migraines," eventually my grandmother explained. "Inherited from her," she would admit with guilt in her voice. Only she knew how to comfort me. Most times when they started, I would walk the 5 minutes to her house from school. She'd put me in a dark bedroom and wrap a tight wash rag around my head, then sit on the edge of the bed with me, talking quietly in the darkness as we waited it out. After the flashing lights dissolved in my field of vision, then the pain of the migraines started for real. Hot pokered anvils beaten to flatness inside my head. There she is, the girl that I was, the year before the grain elevator burned down. She's 13. Her profile is flatter, her hair straighter, but still, it's the same girl. She's mowing the lawn on the 4th of July. See how immaculate are the lines she is making on her parents' dried-up lawn? The rows are perfect, like a landing strip she is preparing for someone who may be passing overhead. Already she is scanning the horizon for methods of escape. Light aircraft, men in goggles with long scarves streaming behind them. Already she is scheming quick passage out of this dust hole, this graveyard that her father inherited from his father, inherited, in turn, from all the fathers who came before. Looking at the sky and thinking so intensely of flight, she feels the first jagged stab of menstrual pain crack at her navel and bury itself deep in her pelvis. She doesn't bother to go inside and find out what's happened. She understands the ever-widening stain that now spreads through her layers. Instead, she keeps on working, looking only as far ahead as the expanse of her parents' lawn, concentrating on finishing another long row before the afternoon sun rises too high in the sky. Later, inside the house, she finds the cache of pads in the cupboard above the bathtub. Over the years, she has watched this giant blue box empty and fill, never understanding until this moment the true significance of all this mysterious activity. Later, after supper is eaten and the sun has disappeared, the girl gathers with the rest of her family on the newly mown lawn to watch the fireworks. Her grandparents bring their folding chairs. Her father brings his cooler. Her mother spreads a blanket, and her brother, who is going through a teenage boy phase inspired by the space program that makes him yearn to light, incinerate, and explode things into the sky, acts as official torchbearer, igniting bottle rocket after bottle rocket, shooting star after shooting star into the still night air. As fountains of light hiss, spit, and transform into streams of gold in the sky, then fan into shapes of exotic flowers, the girl that I was lies down in the cool grass with her sisters and oohs and ahs in appreciation. The summer after the grain elevator burned down, it began to rise slowly out of the ashes with the help of young workmen who appeared in the small town as if by magic. They were tanned and rough-skinned. Their hair was thick and dry as straw from the sun. They were from another part of the state. The farm girls savored the thought. Fresh blood. New gene pool. The young workmen came to town with names like Leroy and Dale, Jimmy and George. They had cigarette packs stuffed in the pockets of their denim work shirts or bundled in the sleeves of their white T-shirts. They had rugged jawlines and razor stubble. They drove pumpkin orange Mustangs and convertible GTOs with earthquake stereos and Richter-breaking mufflers. They had warm cases of Schlitz in the trunks of their cars. Every day, the people of the small town crossed the railroad tracks on their way from the courthouse to the bar or from the church to the store. As they passed the construction site, they stopped to watch the workers move on the girders of the newly emerging structure. Every day, the girl that I was passed the elevator and watched the men pound in nails with their tanned, muscular arms. One of the workmen was a lanky Nordic type. He was well into the sky when she first saw him. He was dangling on the ledge of a girder, a leather safety belt strapped to his waist, his thick yellow hair blowing in the wind. He cut a striking figure up there with the sun blazing behind him, like a phoenix rising. The moment could be highly elusive. But it would be a mistake to assume that the girl that I was saw him as anything other than shirtless, big-armed, and well-tanned. Perhaps it was that walk of hers, that careless, mad march that attracted his attention. She was crossing the railroad tracks on the way to her grandmother's house. This is no joke. She really was going to visit her grandmother. when she heard his whistle come from high above. She looked into the glare and saw only the flash of his white, white, very white teeth. One of the things the girl that I was enjoyed doing with her friends was drive around. They'd pile in their cars and pass by other young people from their small town who were also driving around. They'd nod once, or lift an index finger from the steering wheel to acknowledge each other as they passed. The main street of their small town was 3 blocks long, bordered by a city park, which ended in a U-turn. As the young people busied themselves driving around on Main Street, they'd wave at each other coming and going. Then they'd make the U-turn and wave at each other again, going and coming. Eventually, they'd get bored with this and angle park their cars in front of the rec hall. One night, at the rec, where everybody went to play pool, smoke cigarettes, and eat the biggest orders of 25-cent French fries in town, the girl that I was met up with a lanky workman from another part of the state. His name was George, although he was no dragon slayer. He came to town in a 2-toned blue 56 Chevy with no reverse gear and very little left of first. He was terrified of heights, but he was even more afraid of poverty, so he overcame his bad nerves each day, climbing the scaffolding, weak-kneed and hungover, rising higher and higher in the sky as the summer progressed. She got close enough to notice that his breath smelled of spearmint, for he chewed gum liberally, flipping it around in his mouth with his tongue as he spoke, chattering away about something she did not understand because she was concentrating so exclusively on the length and shape and firmness of his thighs. He had showered and changed. His hair was bleached and damp, and his skin was rosy from the sun. He wore a yellow shirt stripped open to his navel, revealing a nest of burnished chest hair. Perhaps this George, this elevator man, reminded her of a Viking marauder as he laughed and stroked his mustache. His lamb chop sideburns were dark and wispy, trailing down the sides of his face. When given the opportunity to browse, the girl that I was thought, she was certain to find every conceivable color of hair on this man's body. They talked, but they talked of nothing, George and this girl that I was, for they had no common words with which to work. All they had were grunts and laughs, gestures and sighs, and fragments of words that they'd heard and vaguely understood, which they offered now to each other, peppering the silence that hung between them. When he began his little dance, those circuitous steps he felt obliged to do to get her into his car, it came out seamless, a blending of feigned shyness, sly innuendo, and a fair amount of chest pounding. That night in the rec hall, she watched this George, this second-story man, do his little dance, knowing that it was not necessary, that it was never necessary for her sake, but allowing it to continue, recognizing, in her characteristic early wisdom, that it was necessary for him to do. As they cruised Maine, he smiled at her with his immaculate wide grin and fiddled with the radio. She studied the leathery quality of his large hands, wanting more than anything to trace with her finger the smooth line of his distinctive nose, the shape of which, when she encountered it later in life on the faces of other men, she would come to call an intelligent nose. Riding along in this 2-toned 56 Chevy, with no reverse gear and very little left of first, the girl that I was did not think about trailer courts or dirty dishes piled in the sink or babies crying late into the night. She was lighting a cigarette, bending the tip deep into the flame, and when the ash grew long on the tip, she didn't flick it. She leaned back, just leaned back in complete repose. And even though he was a stranger in town, she didn't bother to give him directions. So confident was she that he would find a way to get them wherever this girl that I was wanted to go. Eventually, as teenagers, we discovered uses for the land that did not involve work. Wild nights, we partied and parked in the moraine, the low glacial hills that run in a 10-mile-wide belt north of my hometown. On summer weekends, after the work was done, we drove up and down the hills, coming to park deep in the moraine, beyond the reach of the law. Rows of cars lined up along the rim of the hills. Dozens of lovers went to those cars for privacy, or took blankets and went out deeper into the country for sex on the land. Thousands of years ago in this spot, the Wisconsinan glacier dropped mounds of ice and the last of its chewed-up boulders and receded north toward the Hudson Bay as if suddenly intrigued by work in other quarters. The moraines that formed consist of rough belts of glacial hills that run like a diagonal line through the state of North Dakota. One of the moraines skirts the northeast edge of my family's farm as it goes through Logan County. As teenagers, we understood nothing of the deep geological history of our family land. During the day, we knew these morainic hills only from planting and harvesting. Each ridge remembered in our bodies after long hours of strain and sweat. The rocks the glacier left behind were a nuisance that had to be cleared year after year as they surfaced. But in the ravines of the moraine, on summer weekends, we tapped kegs, lit bonfires. We danced around the flames that flared 15 feet tall. Car doors were thrown open. Stereos blared. Women laughed in the night, the body opening with alcohol, the sweet forgetting that spreads through the brain. The land lay around us like a telluric body, protecting us with its silence, its impassive largeness. The land loved us in our youth. It would never reveal to our parents what we had done in its presence. In The Myth of the Eternal Return, Mircea Eliade noted that references to agricultural mysticism can be traced back to Greek myth. Demeter lay with Iasion on the newly sown ground at the beginning of spring. The meaning of this union is clear. It contributes to promoting the fertility of the soil. Similarly, James Frazer noted in The Golden Bough that people in many ancient cultures engaged in sex on the land to create the sympathetic influence of the sexes on vegetation. In this view, sex is a blessing to the land, which encourages the forces of creation. Those bonfire nights on the moraine, drinking, dancing, lying together on the land, did we realize we were engaged in an ancient ritual, an act of agricultural mysticism that would promote the fertility of our parents' land? Not at all. We were just horny teenagers. Even on the continent of Europe, Frazer admitted, vestiges of similar rites still existed that could be seen as stunted relics of agricultural mysticism. In the Ukraine, the priests came to bless the fields, then instructed the young married couples to lie down on the sown field and roll down the hills. In the early 1900s, the same practice of rolling down slopes together after the blessing of the land could still be found in parts of England. In Russia, Frazer explained, the priest himself laid down in his long robes and vestments and rolled with the couples. If he was reluctant to do so, the participants urged him on, imploring, "You do not wish us to have corn, although you do wish us to live on our corn." Here, the relationship between human sexuality, fertility of the land, and productivity of crops is clear. Our rude forefathers, Fraser wrote, personified the powers of vegetation as male and female. Joining their bodies to the land in the acts of sexual intercourse, they attempted, on the principle of homeopathic or imitative magic, to quicken the growth of trees and plants. In Amboina, Fraser noted, cultural anthropologists observed that the clove farmers went naked into the fields at night when they feared the harvest would be inadequate, and they ejaculated on the trees, shouting, "More cloves! More cloves!" And the husbandmen of Java had sex in the fields with their wives to encourage the bloom on the rice fields. The Pipiles of Central America kept apart from their wives until the planting, then indulged their passions, even appointing members of the tribe to perform the sexual act at the moment the seeds were planted. Fraser reported that the Nabateans, when grafting the branch of one tree onto another, would choose a maiden to insert the graft while she, in turn, was approached from behind by a male member of the tribe, who inserted himself into her to emulate the graft. Fraser concluded, "The marriage of the trees and plants could not be fertile without the real union of the human sexes." These charms and rituals, he explained, were intended to encourage the woods to grow green, the fresh grass to sprout, the corn to shoot, and the flowers to bloom. Here lies the mythic essence of husbandry, the core of agricultural mysticism. By making love on the land, the husbandman symbolically marries himself to the earth in a binding contract. The couple's union blesses the land, ensuring the fertility of the crops. Children are produced from the union that takes sustenance from the fruit, corns, and grains. The fruit feeds upon the fruit. This arrangement ensures that the land will have a caretaker and that the caretaker will have a home. At the end of their lives, the cycles of generations are returned to the earth to provide sustenance to the land. But what about the girl that I was, the daughter of agriculture who refused to be seeded or planted? "I will lie down on my father's land and rise up with nothing but my pleasure to show for it." By choosing pleasure over fertilization, I fear I have committed an act of extravagance that separates me irrevocably from the long line of agricultural women in my family. It's not that I lied exactly. It's just that I was in possession of certain information that I did not disclose the night I was 16 and the inside of my mom and dad's car burned down. It was the first night of my first job, and my mom had announced that I could take the car instead of the pickup, which I normally drove to school events. I was nervous as I dressed for my first day of work at Maggie's, the main restaurant in town, situated at the intersection where Highway 3 passed by the grain elevators. I slipped into my red and white waitress uniform. I polished my white shoes. It was a warm fall afternoon, and I was looking forward to having a real job where I would receive real pay. By 16, I had already quit smoking, but I bummed a cigarette from my sister's pack, thinking it would calm me down on the ride to town. Once on the road, I lit the cigarette, but I quickly realized I no longer liked the taste of it. My parents' blue Chevy had one of those virgin ashtrays that had never seen an ash, much less the searing tip of a cigarette butt, so I cracked open the window, tossed out the almost unsmoked cigarette, sealed the window, and cruised into town, parking my car in the lot across from Maggie's, directly below the towering grain elevators. The cook who greeted me at the door had worked Maggie's night shift for almost 30 years. She was a lifer, with thick, grease-smeared glasses. She took me under her wing, as she must have done for hundreds of girls before me, showing me where the break room and the time clock were. Maggie walked me around the cafe, going over the menu, showing me how the cash register worked. I was starting to get the hang of it 3 hours into my shift. There was a rhythm you could catch, an unstoppable flow that allowed you to sequence out the orders, delivering the daily special, the steak and potatoes, the hamburgers and cheeseburgers, the fries and shakes, all the while checking back to deliver bills and fill cups of coffee in between. The tables were starting to thin, I noticed, but the restaurant was full. People had begun to leave their seats and collect at the front of the cafe, where a large plate glass window faced the grain elevator parking lot. But I was a professional. I had many refills to pour. I would not be distracted away from my appointed tasks. Eventually, the tables were deserted. All the customers were standing by the window, their coffee cups turning cold at their tables. They were staring at something going on across the street. I noticed then a flashing red light strobing over their heads as they milled around. I moved closer, peeked through an opening between them, and could just make out my parents' car in the parking lot across the street, with all four doors thrown open. A fire engine was parked at a crazy angle beside it, as if they had rushed to the scene. Firemen were standing on either side of the car, hosing down the smoldering interior. "My car!" I screamed, and all the customers parted to the side for me. I rushed through the opening, out the door, and across the street, just in time to watch a fireman, on his knees, pull one charred cigarette butt from between the exposed molding of what had been our blue Chevy's back seat. "Looks like a cigarette," the fireman said to his partners. Then he looked at me. "This your car? Looks like somebody threw a cigarette in here." I glanced in the back seat. The wiring was completely exposed, and it was still sparking and fizzing. The firemen left after they'd sufficiently extinguished the car, and I walked across the street to Maggie's to call my mom and dad. I blubbered over the phone about the car and a cigarette and some sparking electrical wires in the back seat. My parents told me to calm down and hang up. They called my sister and her husband, who lived 3 blocks away, and told them to rush right over. By then, my shift was practically done, so Maggie gave me the rest of the night off. All the excitement was over anyway. The crowd had gone home. My brother-in-law bravely started up the engine, and my sister and I followed him to the farm, watching the headlights and taillights blink on and off in response to little eruptions of sparks in the smoldering wiring. The way I remember it, my parents were sleeping when we got home, but that can't be possible. They must have stayed awake to look at the car. We must have talked about it. But my next memory of the event is that I woke up in the morning with my mother sitting at my bedside watching me sleep. She looked at me sympathetically as soon as I opened my eyes. She stroked my hair and asked me if I felt all right. We made small talk about my first night of work. Had I liked it? Did I get a lot of tips? I began to tell her I was sorry about the car, that I had no idea. "I know," she said. "Some hoodlum must have come by and thrown a cigarette in the back seat as a prank." "Uh-huh," I said, biting my tongue. "It must have been some hoodlum." I don't know why my mother granted me amnesty that morning. Some act of kindness that I'll never be able to repay. But the secret weighed on me. I wanted to tell it as I watched my mother and father get the wiring repaired in the car. And we must leave right in the middle of this story, and leave our reading of The Horizontal World, Growing Up Wild in the Middle of Nowhere, written by Deborah Marquardt, who is professor of English at Iowa State University and coordinator of the creative writing program there. I'm Mary Richards, producer of this program, The Community Bookshelf, which you can listen to every Monday, Tuesday, and Wednesday at this time. Assistant producer is Janet Kloss. Chief engineer is Rick Morrison, and program engineer is Ron Latson. We welcome comments and suggestions for other readings at 515-292-2878 or khoiradio@gmail.com. Thanks for listening. You have been listening to KHOI's Community Bookshelf. This is Mary Richards. Thanks very much for listening.